Hey everyone, and welcome to episode number 265 of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. This is Stephanie Wong, and today I brought on Abdul. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you. How are you doing?
Good. All the way from Stockholm, right?
Yeah, the weather is getting better, so I'm happy.
Good. Okay, so since this is the first time we've had you on the podcast, tell us about yourself a little bit.
Sure. Abdel, that's my nickname for my very long name, which is Abdel Feta. I am a cloud engineer, part of working for the PSO, Professional Services Organization, which is the consulting branch of Google Cloud. And I have background in infrastructure and I specialize on serverless and Kubernetes.
Fun. Okay, so you came to me because you had an incredible guest that you wanted to recommend. So who are we talking to today?
Yes, we're talking to Jan, who is an infrastructure engineer at Sharkmob, which is one of the many gaming studios in Sweden, in Malmo. I met him back in 2018 when he was a speaker in DevFest in our office, and he gave a very amazing talk about their experience at the time launching The Division 2, which is a very popular FPS game on GCP, and you know, migrating game servers from on-prem.
We love when people willingly go to the DevFest and want to share their experiences and learnings with them. So I'm really excited to have him on today. And quick question, why is it that we have so many gaming studios in Sweden?
That's a very interesting question. I have no idea. I worked with a lot of gaming studios. I think part of it is just historical. Stockholm or Sweden generally have a very vibrant startup scene. And they encourage the digital area to, like, you know, flourish in this country. And, you know, it's the headquarters of Spotify.
Ah, yes. Very true. So you said that it's this home of digital transformation and startup scene. And Jan is going to share his experience about how they're able to transition to the cloud. So we are still seeing a big migration and shift in technology even there.
Yeah. And the most important thing is we didn't pay him to say all the good things he said about GCP.
Exactly. Again, sharing his experience with everyone. So before we get into the conversation, though, I want to cover some cool things of the week. So let's go ahead and do that. All right. So my cool thing of the week is, if you didn't already hear about this, we had a really big launch in our compute scene. So we have a new virtual machine family called Tau VMs coming to Google Cloud, and they extend our compute engine offerings with this new option, and it's optimized for cost-effective performance for scale-out workloads. So the first VM type in the family is called T2D. And it's based on the third gen AMD EPYC processors. And so what's cool about this is that they did a benchmark performance test for this, as they do. And we were able to see 56% higher absolute performance and 42% higher price performance compared to the general purpose VMs from the other leading public cloud vendors. So encourage you all to check it out. If you're interested in signing up to try it out, we'll include a link in the show notes.
Nice. Even faster CPUs.
For less cost?
It's for, like, less money.
Else,
exactly.
What you want? So what about you? What's your cool thing?
I have two of them, actually. So we just announced a new integration with a Cloud DNS from GKE called the Container Native Cloud DNS. This is actually making GKE even better because now we can break our reliance on KubeDNS, so in-cluster DNS, in favor of an integration with GCP's managed DNS service called Cloud DNS, lowering the operational burden on cluster administrators so you don't need actually to allocate resources inside the cluster for your DNS anymore.
Wow, awesome. I'm still learning about this, but I was reading about it. It seems like now you have tooling, monitoring, logging that you get from Cloud DNS, and you can use it for DNS resolution in GKE as well without separate systems. So it seems like a more unified, integrated approach to that.
Yeah, the second one is a Google for Game Developer Summit, since this episode is about gaming, obviously. So that's taking place online on July 12 and 13. We will be sharing new products and solutions across Google. You will be able to catch deep dives of full practices to help you continue creating great games, connecting with players, and scaling your business.
Very appropriate for today's conversation. So for all the game developers or those who want to follow the scene, check out the summit. We'll include the links in the show notes. And I'm sure it's going to be filled with a lot of experts and learn about the latest that's happening in game dev. So check it out. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into our conversation with Jan from Sharkmob. Yeah, and I'm so excited to have you on to the podcast. Finally, I know it's been a little while. Why don't you go ahead and just tell everyone a little bit about you and your experience? I know you've been at Massive and Sharkmob. Tell us about them.
Yeah, my name's Jan. I'm expert online infrastructure engineer. It's a ridiculous title. I've been working for Massive for 6 years and SharkMob for coming up to a year now. And I'm responsible mostly for the online platform. So the matchmaking systems, the authentication systems, the gameplay systems, profile storage, things like that. And I'm focusing mostly on architecture and reliability, not so much on the programming.
I mean, we had the chance to have Jan speak at one of our GDG conferences, DevFest 2018, when we could get together. And you talked about Massive, and that was just after the launch of the Division 2 game, which I love, by the way. It's awesome. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Like, what was your role? What did you do? What was your involvement in the infrastructure space? And how did you came to actually use GCP?
Well, it kind of goes back to the first Division game. I was one of only a couple of engineers who were kind of the first ones doing that job for a game. Usually we have this internal organization, which is like an IT organization, and everything becomes monolithic because of that. So if you have an online game, then you would go to this central service based out of Paris or Montreal, and you would ask, hey, I want a dedicated server, and they would say how big, and you might get it in 6 to 12 months. But this was like a massive multiplayer game that they were thinking of making, the Division 1, I mean. So it made way more sense to have that team embedded in the development team. So that's where me and a couple of colleagues, we got hired, we went in, we spent a long time understanding how the game was going to work, how everything functioned on a binary kind of byte level, and then making a tailored solution for that based on physical hardware. And it was kind of a long process, and we learned a lot from the first game, and we made a lot of mistakes, and we made a lot of things really well. But then it came closer and closer, or a bit more obvious that we were going to make a sequel. And then it was more of a question of, if we could redo it, knowing what we know now, what would we do differently? And one of the main things, I think, was the flexibility. We had very limited flexibility in terms of like the physical machines we had. There was an incredibly long lead time to get them. When they failed, it was kind of a big deal. So it made more sense to make things a bit more agnostic in that way and maybe look at some cloud providers. And we did a very extensive evaluation. You know, due diligence is important. And well, GCP came out on top by a relatively big margin. So then we managed to launch Division 2, and there were way less problems than the first game. So I was very happy with this.
Wow. Yeah, that's what we like to hear, right? So I'm really glad that you found success through that. But I was just thinking about the different model between on-premise provisioning and cloud. Obviously, the life cycle is much longer when you're talking about managing your own private data center and hardware. So what were some of the biggest differences that you noticed when you did decide to move to GCP?
Oh, there are quite a few. Well, one of the biggest and best differences was that our dev environments looked exactly like production environments. That was really cool because then we found problems way ahead of time. What tends to happen if you only have physical machines is if you want to have a dev environment, then you're going to bundle everything on one machine and just like push it out. Like maybe it's a developer's machine, or even if it's a like a UAT, you know, like a user acceptance testing machine where you give it to a client, or like say NVIDIA or AMD, and they want to test the game, then you basically fit it all into one box on one operating system and then just like, here you go, here it kind of works, all jumbled together. But when it comes to cloud way of doing things, because you can make those microservice instances much, much smaller, you can have a separate game server that's a bit smaller. You can have a separate authentication server that's a bit smaller. You can have a tiny little database. And you can use all the same provisioning scripts, say it's Terraform, or if it was CloudFormation, if it was Amazon. You can have all of that be the same. So you can really test your deployment system in a really robust way because you're constantly using it instead of just like, okay, we have all these UAT environments, and then on production day one, we're going to have 2,000 physical machines over there. So program for those 2,000 machines, but you're not going to have any experience doing that yet. So that was probably the biggest and best difference between like on-prem versus cloud. And obviously, I can talk about the life cycle of machines. Like, it's mostly in terms of reliability. Like when I call a Google API, I can be pretty sure that I'm going to get a positive return back. And if I don't, then I can handle that return. I'm going to get a machine at the end of it, basically. And then it will tell me. But with physical machines, it can be a bit different. They have this ILO, out-of-band management interface, and it has some API programmatic access. But because it's like very proprietary, maybe misunderstood, you know, you can get into situations where the machine is not behaving as you would expect. So even rebuilding a machine through that API can be not only time-consuming, but really not fun because it's not doing what it says it will do. These are the two main things I would say are large differences between on-prem versus cloud.
Cool. That's actually great. And there is another aspect of cloud when we think about it versus like bare metal is like scalability, right? With bare metal or with on-prem, you're only going to get as much CPU out of the physical servers you have. But then people, when they go to cloud, they have this like understanding of how the cloud is unlimited. You know, I can make an API call and get like 3,000 VMs provisioned. Of course, I mean, at the end of the day, it runs on top of some physical servers. How did cloud help you scale, especially when you launched the game?
So it's a different target, I think, when we talk about scalability in the cloud. The thing is that it's limiting and unlimiting at the same time. You can say we can make an API call and get 2,000 machines. And actually, that tends to be not true. If you go and ask for 2,000 machines, you're actually going to get, we're out of resources response. So you have to understand how to deal with that as well, because we did try and do that. And we did get that message quite a few times, actually. But especially when our machines are like, I don't know, 64 to 100 core machines, you know, it's like, yeah, that's kind of difficult for anyone. But the thing is, a lot of programmers, when they write software, especially if it's low-level C++, they're going to write single-threaded applications wherever they can. There's going to be some like thread starvation. And Google Cloud, at least at the time when we were onboarding with it, was a lot of 2 gigahertz CPUs. So you can have as many cores as you want, or up to a limit, of course, like 98 cores or something like that. If you're highly single-threaded, then you're dead in the water, basically. I had a really good experience because we were writing our own game engine, and you know, Massive has the Snowdrop engine, which was built like next generation from the ground up, really good with multi-threading. It was so good that you could just aggregate all of the cores together and say, what's the total number of gigahertz I have? And that's going to give you a rough estimate of performance. And that's pretty much unheard of, even with multi-threaded applications, because there's always overhead in multi-threading, you know, context switching between threads. So I was incredibly lucky. Now I work with Unreal, and Unreal, unfortunately, does have the single-threaded problem. It loves to be on one or two threads. And I think Unreal is used by many people, so they're all aware of this. But it's a problem for me at the moment. But then you've got the new CPU types. You've got the AMD Epic Rome. Have you had some as well? The Cascade Lake machines that were a bit higher core frequency. But they're not everywhere. And this is also the problem. You've got to understand what your model is before you go into it.
Yeah, I've been doing more reading about the AMD EPYC processors recently. And it's exciting because Google is investing in that area as well. And you mentioned having to take inventory and really plan before you decide to migrate your workloads over. Now that cloud native applications are usually more prevalently built using a distributed architecture, have you had to do major changes in the way that you've designed your environments, or more or less have had a seamless transition into moving over to the cloud?
It's mostly seamless, I can say. I mean, everything seems to work. If it works on-prem, that's the hard part, because you get more when you go into the cloud. You just get like some really nice convenience functions, right? I find that a lot of people, when they're really serious about making a distributed system with on-prem systems, they either reach for Zookeeper or they build their own kind of service discovery system. We had that at Massive. We had our own service discovery system, and it was fantastically fast, like phenomenally fast. Like there's no comparing to it. But that amount of effort to make that thing is very high. Like it's insanely high. I mean, we're talking like C++ programmers working for half a year to make that system as robust as it was, at least. But you go into the cloud and suddenly you get this for free. And okay, yeah, it's not as tailored or it's not as fast or whatever, but it works. And it works pretty well. And it works for the general case or the 95% case. So we could take our own service discovery system to the cloud because we built it for on-prem and all of that stuff just works. But we could also have not spent 6 months designing this thing. So it's a trade-off.
That's actually very interesting. You just made kind of an analogy to the microservices versus monolithic, where in the microservices space, you're spending a lot of time perfecting a service that does a very specific thing. And in the monolithic world, you're just like throwing lines of code into a single binary and just hoping for the best, basically crossing your fingers. But I just want to follow up on Stephanie's question. She spoke about cloud native, which is this new term we've been using around like the last couple of years. And since I am a Kubernetes snob, why not Kubernetes for your specific use case, for game servers in general?
Okay, for game servers, okay, there is Agones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've been very keen, like keeping a very close eye on that. I got Mark Mendel to give a presentation to the guys at SharkMob, including the CTO, and they love it. Absolutely, they love it. But the unfortunate thing is we're very, very close to shipping our first game with multiplayer. So we're already like built into the multiplayer APIs and the way of working with it and their deployment strategy and so on. But I think for the future, it's a distinct possibility that we're going to very closely look at Agones. When it comes to Massive, I know that there's been a huge shift away after I left because I was working on shifting away, but everything's built on Windows. You give 300 to 600 people Windows workstations. You tell them they are not allowed to run virtual machines. And every time they ask for a machine, it takes 6 to 12 months to get. Well, then they're going to make their server software on Windows because that's all they have. And that's exactly what happened with Massive. So they spent 7 to 10 years making a new game engine and a game that goes on top of it. It's all Windows. And then obviously Linux gets introduced when I join, which is, I don't know, like a year before launch. And I mean, they've tested everything. It's done. And you can't take what they've made, even if it is microservices, you can't just take it and put it in a container. Because back in what, 2014 to 2016-ish area, there is no Windows Kubernetes. So it wasn't even on the cards. And then later on, as time goes on, it's like, well, it's a lot of work and we have basically everything we need with what we have. We have our own orchestration system. We have our own service discovery system. But obviously that has to give. And for the new Avatar game that's coming out, I have high confidence that it's not going to be Windows. It's going to be with Kubernetes. It's going to be on GKE. I can't say for certain. And if I knew, I wouldn't say. So it's a super secret game. So, but I have high confidence. Everything with regards to the backend infrastructure, it's not an evolution with the Avatar game. It's a revolution. It's significantly better than everything we've done before. And that includes porting everything properly to Linux and making the game servers work on Linux.
Yeah, another step in that transformation and migration, which is a multi-month, multi-year process for some companies. But I kind of want to shift the conversation and talk a little bit about SharkMob. I know that was a different situation migrating cloud. So can you tell us a bit about what that was like?
Yeah, actually, SharkMob was an interesting one because I came in as the first and only like SRE type or platform engineer type. So there was a DevOps engineer who came before and he was an expert on AWS. And he actually really helped me open my eyes because I'm one of these people who's very cloud phobic. I like to understand what things are doing and well, clouds are relatively proprietary and they're VMs by definition. So there's a lot happening that's opaque. And the thing is, I like GCP mostly because it's very transparent about how opaque it is in a way. They do really interesting things on the hypervisor. I've talked to some of the engineers who worked on the hypervisor even. Props to you guys for letting me talk nerd to some of your most nerdy people, by the way.
We love to do that.
But I can say that they try to give you predictable performance and they do a very good job of it. And I can verify that they do a very good job of it. So I'm very happy with GCP in that way, but I am cloud phobic, so I don't want to learn AWS and I don't really want to learn GCP, which is ironic given that I'm on a GCP podcast. But, you know, I like understanding what I'm doing. So it's great that he was there and he was an expert on AWS. And I go in and I start asking questions like, hey, how does this work? He explains how it works. I say, but what about this other thing? How does that intersect with this thing? I was like, it kind of doesn't. So what I have to do is Lambda function and this and that and the other thing. Okay, that seems really complicated, actually. How are we going to maintain this in perpetuity? It's like, well, it should just work. No, it's not hope. We don't build platforms worth billions of dollars on hopes and dreams. We build them on engineering. And, you know, the more I dug into how everything was working, the more I understood that even though he was an expert and his expertise was incredibly valuable, that the thing that it was most valuable in doing was informing me how AWS was not a good fit for us, because he would explain the breadth of all this wonderful stuff, but it was all super, super esoteric in its own way and didn't have a holistic idea in it. And everything became overly complicated. And it's totally the antithesis of what I assumed cloud to be, because I had this experience with Google Cloud where, well, they had a service discovery system that was nearly as good as ours, and it would have saved us a lot of engineering time. And that's what I thought cloud was at that point. You take the 95% case and you save a bunch of time and you pay a bit of money for it. That totally makes sense to me. Like, that's a good value proposition. But AWS, at least the way we were using it, was not. It was very much, we spend significantly more time on more complicated solutions and we pay for it. So it was really difficult for me to get my head around. And after a while, I said, look, I don't really trust that I can deliver a good quality service on AWS because this is how you currently use it. And this is how it could be in Google. I mean, you're using this container system that Amazon provides. And I could probably just port that to Kubernetes. And then if we do the migration to GCP and you don't like it, we can still go back to Amazon. We can go on-prem. We can go to Azure. We can go anywhere because we've done the hard work of lifting it out of a proprietary solution, putting it on something open. And now we can just move it anywhere. I did a proof of concept for that, and it was a lot of hard work. And props to my new engineer at the time, Max, fantastic work. We sat down, we coded everything. Like, we had to write all these wonderful Python wrappers so that developers could just run the same commands as they were running, but against like Minikube and the GKE, and it was transparent whether they were using their own or whatever. It was really good. They loved it. They were like, this is amazing. Okay, we replaced some service discovery stuff. They were using their own service discovery system because, like I said, people tend to write their own service discovery systems. And we replaced it with the GKE load balancers. So, you know, the service load balancers between each system. And yeah, okay, we found some problems. You know, we wanted to keep persistent connections open, and there's some limitations on what you can do with that, especially with ingresses. But I mean, there was nothing insurmountable, and the documentation was great. And so far, I mean, they're very happy. And I guess time will tell if it was a good decision, because we're going to release a game soon and probably it's going to be great and no one will have any problems. Overall, I would say people are more happy and the transition has been a very good one. And now, actually, when we deploy an environment, it's like it wasn't massive when I said about the dev environments that looked like prod. Well, now the dev environments look like prod, whereas the dev environments when I joined were one RDS instance, which is a MySQL machine in Amazon that everyone connected to. And they templated their SQL with like variables that they would replace so they wouldn't collide with each other on their dev environments.
It's pretty cool to listen to your story, because as people from inside of Google, we also tend to want things to be simple for our customers, obviously, but we also tend to sometimes catch some like, you know, friction in the usage and then just complain to the PMs. It's like, hey, this is not working as it's supposed to be working. But it's great to have somebody from the outside give a testimony. So from SharkMob, you did this migration from AWS to GCP. What were the main challenges besides the ones you talked about, like using new service discovery? What other challenges you have faced in that transition?
That's a really good question. There were a couple. I even have a web page where I listed all the things I hated about AWS and all the reasons we couldn't move away. And actually, mostly it was people tying themselves into AWS APIs. It was developers who didn't want to know anything about infrastructure. And to them, cloud was infrastructure. It's not C sharp or it's not C++, therefore it's infrastructure and I don't want to think about it. Perfectly legit. You know, it's a perfectly valid way of working. Not everyone should do everything, in my opinion. But that led to situations where someone who knew how to do something in AWS just to get their job done, they now suddenly had to relearn how to do it in GCP or the GCP way. So that was kind of a big problem for a couple of people. Then there was like CloudWatch. You know, we had some API integrations into CloudWatch, and if couldn't do it, then it would crash. That was annoying. But it's not insurmountable, right? It's not the biggest problem in the world. I think a lot of people had trouble understanding when we did have a problem that it might be something unrelated to the cloud provider. Because when you make a big change and then you see a problem, you can just immediately blame the big change because it makes sense. But overall, it was an incredibly smooth transition. It was just convincing people that it could be done. 6 months away from launch, something like that, or 6 months away from some amount of like readiness. I think I said to the lead developer, like, I stake my career on this working. I mean, it was really complicated to convince directors and people like this. Like, if we go with AWS, we could probably do it. But if we go with GCP, we can definitely do it. It's a hard thing to convey as an engineer to a director or to a person who's been developing stuff on AWS before or has been like leading this team for a while. I had to say something to the tune of, yeah, I stake my reputation. I stake my career on this working. You're going to have to trust me, I'm afraid.
And, wow.
I mean, it worked. Yeah. So,
yeah. I mean, it sounds like there are two places that you needed to convince. It was bottom up and top down in some sense, because you mentioned having to convince a team of developers to reorient their skills to a different platform is using those hours that from higher up probably wouldn't want to devote time to. So, how did you create that pros and cons list for both bottom up and top down?
Yeah. So, directors love graphs, basically how I did it. So when it comes to director level decisions, I tend to do weighted decision matrix. I sit down and I ask the directors and the engineers, like, what are the things you value most in X? And I do this with basically everything. I do it with the logging systems. I do it with monitoring systems. I did it with cloud providers. So what do you want most out of a cloud provider? And they would say something like the ability to get servers. Well, that's pretty obvious. And maybe they want ease of use, or maybe they want reliability. You know, if you have a VM, you don't want it to randomly just shut down or lose its data or anything like this. And then more and more, it becomes like predictable performance. And then eventually they start talking about helper systems, but it's way at the bottom. People like to say, oh, but Amazon supports Elasticsearch. But the real thing is most game developers don't care. They just care about predictable performance and they care about reliability. Because especially when it's a game server, it's persistent connection most of the time, the state involved, you don't want to lose it. It's not like a web request where you can just like throw away the connection or not serve it and expect the load balancer to pick up the slack. It's totally not like that. So I made that list and then I asked them to grade which ones they deemed most important, like scale of 1 to 10. When you can only have 1 to 10, so you have to really choose which 10 you want. And then they pick the thing they want. I go through and I give them scores out of like 1 to 5 on each metric. So I say, oh, you don't want your VM to be shut down. Well, Google supports this migration strategy. And I've used it for 5 years and I never had a problem with it. Whereas Amazon supports this. And then we started talking about like the preemptiveness. So Amazon sends you a notification like 24 hours before they shut down a node, whereas Google's just not going to shut down the node. So that's a difference, right? So maybe Google gets a 5, Amazon gets a 3, Azure maybe lower. You know, it's a bit like this. And then we go through the whole list and you get a score at the end and you say, well, which one's better? Which one do you want to support in perpetuity? Because once we ship this game, we're not going to change this. So it's better to do this now and to like rip the bandaid off and do it than it is to wait and then have a really painful migration later because we realized some stuff that we didn't think about in the beginning.
Yeah, you mentioned you made this decision about 6 months before a game had to be launched. Is that true?
Some release gate. Mm-hmm. I don't know about launch, but it was like 6 months before some release gate of some kind. And we were like pretty much trying to lock everything and go full bug fix mode and alpha quality everything. And like, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a very late change, to be fair.
Did you have a hybrid period of time?
No. So we do API versioning, luckily. So between one version and the next, we could basically redo everything. So we got away with that. And because it was pre-production, we didn't have any state to take care of. It would have been really hard to migrate state out of Amazon later. I know of a project in Ubisoft. Essentially, it's the centralized authentication services. And if you work on that project, you know who you are and you do a fantastic job. And I love you very much. Really, they do great. But it's all developers. And they did this migration from, I think it was on-prem to AWS in their case. But it was really painful. It was so painful. It had to be done in stages because certain services needed to be moved and they would need to talk back inside the Ubisoft network in some ways. And it was prolonged and very painful for everyone using them. I mean, I was a user of this service as a person making a game. The Division games used this service and I could see the error rates because I can see authentication errors, of course. And I could see ticket token invalid errors and I can see all of this and I can see that it's, they have a really long period of sustained high error rates, like low level ones. So it's constant, but low level. And then after the migration had been finished, it was suddenly like, wow, there's a lot less downtimes on this service now. But it took a long time and it was, must have been really painful for everyone involved. So I'm really glad we got to bypass that problem.
That's pretty interesting. So you basically did the lift and shift within 6 months and you had to put your career on the line.
The whole transition took 2 weeks.
There you go.
Oh, wow.
That's a tough sell.
You did have a lot of pressure on yourself, though.
Oh, it works. I mean, it was good. I'm glad. You know, you have that fight and flight response. I was like, fight mode for 2 weeks. But it works. I mean, I'm so happy. The thing about Kubernetes, and especially GCP, it's least surprise. When the documentation says something will be a certain way, it is. And it's internally consistent with the way the rest of the system works. And maybe this isn't everyone's experience. I do only work with a subset of GCP, to be honest. Like I said, I'm a hardware guy, and I like knowing how everything works. And I don't go for every feature that you have. I definitely don't look at maps, for instance. But the stuff that I do work with, it works the way you would expect it to work. And all the names are consistent and everything seems to just kind of fit together well. So I was really confident that I could do it in those 2 weeks. And I did. And I mean, we didn't have any shotgun surprises, you know, like things blowing up in front of us. It was really smooth.
That's awesome.
That level of predictability is what you liked, basically. If the documentation says it works, it just works.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't work, it's probably you misconfigured it.
Exactly. Because you use the same key names for everything. You know, if you say, oh, service account here, then it's going to be the same name everywhere else. I mean, it's not going to just change randomly or be uppercase here and lowercase there. And it's all the same.
It's just so nice when things are predictable, consistent, and you can trust your expectations for the service. And that's sort of the benefit that you were looking for in a cloud provider. That's the promise of it, right? So what is coming up for SharkMob? Games that you're launching, and what does the future look like in terms of your experience on Google Cloud and any changes that you're looking to make?
Changes. There will be changes, especially, like I said before, about Agonis. So we actually have two proprietary projects in the works. One of them for sure is our own IP. One is in the conception stage. Those are way out there, but they're in the pipe and we're actively hiring. Please get in contact with us. We need educated people. And if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a very well-educated person. And then soon, TM, I don't actually know when. I intentionally erased my mind of all memory of the launch date. Soon, we are releasing a Vampire the Masquerade Bloodhunt, a battle royale game set in the Vampire the Masquerade universe, where a lot of vampires get cornered in Prague, and you basically have to fight your way through. And it's, of course, it's battle royale, so it's always online, which gives me a job, so I'm very thankful. If you get the chance to sign up for the closed alpha, we have closed alpha on July 3rd, July 4th, around that time. If you sign up before then, you probably get in and you can try it out for yourself.
As an avid gamer, I'm really looking forward to that.
I'll see if I can get you in early, actually.
I'll email you.
As a not avid gamer, I wish you the best in fighting your way out from vampires in a corner in Prague.
Well, the next game is a bit less hopeful than that even, so we'll see.
It gets worse. Well, as we wrap up, is there anything that you wanted to mention, any major takeaways? I mean, we had a ton of learnings just from your experience so far, having done it at two different companies, but anything that you'd like to leave the audience?
Well, if you're listening to this, then you've already embraced the cloud. But if you're embracing the cloud, then GCP is a pretty good way to go. And you should definitely check out Shark Mob Games because, yeah, we're hiring and we make good games, I hope.
Cool.
Well, thank you so much, Jan. We really appreciate you being here, and your experience was enlightening. And we'll include the links to Shark Mob Games and everything else you mentioned in the show notes.
It was an absolute pleasure being here. Thanks for having me. And it's lovely seeing you again, Abdul.
Thank you. Lovely seeing you as well.
Wow. So, Abdul, first of all, thank you for bringing on Jan because he is impressive. Very experienced, very detailed and deep conversation we've had with him. And honestly, I appreciate when we have personal stories on the podcast, right? Because you're hearing it from the source. You're hearing it from people who went through the experience and can provide their takeaways for other people going through the same thing.
Yeah. And the most important, he's a very humble person.
Yes, we love humble. Who doesn't?
Yeah.
And what I loved about the learnings that he brought to the table were that he gave some very practical tips about bringing the advantages and disadvantages for various options, whether it is to remain on AWS or port over their workloads to GCP. And he made it very clear and quantifiable for his leadership to understand the differences.
Yeah, that's actually very cool. I get to do this as well as part of my job. And I hate it when people start just talking about feelings and I don't feel this is going to work. I think that the way you would convince your leadership or your business to move to a certain direction is by actually proving that it would work. And the only way you could prove it is by trying it and just drafting some numbers and say like, oh, this is going to be faster or cheaper.
It also doesn't hurt that he staked his career on it. So yeah. that provided some confidence. It was bold, but hey, he was confident in it. He had tested it. It's not like it was just on a whim. So I'm very excited that he had a positive experience and he was able to meet those scalability and consistency targets while staying within his constraints.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, okay. I know you are always working on some really fun things over on the PSO side of things, our professional services org, but any other projects that you're working on now that you're excited about?
Yep, we just started working on something we're calling the GKE Networking Recipes. This is a document that's basically mixes my love for Kubernetes and my love for food. It's a repository on GitHub. You can check it out as GKE-net-recipes. And we are documenting all the patterns for deploying and exposing applications on GKE using all our load balancing flavors. So each recipe is a self-contained example with detailed explanation and some KPT packages that we're going to be writing for those. So that'd be awesome.
Awesome. Amazing. I mean, it's nice to have it packaged in a way that you can read it as a recipe, especially if there are various ingredients involved, as you were saying, different flavors of the load balancing options. So
exactly.
Great. Well, we'll include the link to that too. And well, I guess for everybody else, we'll see you all next week.
Thank you.